About 5 years ago, I decided to make a career move, not in terms of my teaching, but in terms of my research. For about 20 years, from the time I was a graduate student, I had been working in the field of New Testament textual criticism, which involves taking the surviving manuscripts of the New Testament and comparing them with one another to see where they're different from one another, in an effort to reconstruct what the original New Testament said. And so it involved working with Greek manuscripts and seeing where they were different, and trying to figure out why they differed, why scribes changed their manuscripts. So I worked in that field for about 20 years, and then I got to a point where I thought that was enough. I wanted to do something else with my life, and I was very interested in this question of literary forgery. And so that's what I'm working on, and so that's what I basically talk about. I have just finished a book on this that will be coming out at the end of March by Harper One. It is a book that is entitled Forged. Okay, that wasn't my title. The subtitle Forged. Writing in the Name of God, Why the Authors of the Bible Are Not Who We Think They Are. That's the title. So that is the book for the general population, the Barnes & Noble crowd, the normal human beings who read books. For the abnormal scholars who read books, I'm writing another book, which is the one I'm working on now, which is the hard-hitting scholarly book that I can assure you, you won't want to read. it will be a very serious intellectual kind of thing that uses a lot of German and Greek and Latin and stuff. Don't even try. Don't go there. There are six people in the world who are interested in it, so I thought, keep the crowds small as they are happy. So the way I'm defining literary forgery is this. When somebody writes a book claiming to be someone else, and so if you wrote a book and published it and you signed it Mark Ehrman, right, that would be a forgery. That would be you claiming to be me, and I would not appreciate it. So that phenomenon happened in the ancient world, where somebody would write a book and claim to be the Apostle Paul. Or they would write a book and claim to be the Apostle Thomas. Or they would write a book and claim to be Plato. Or they would write a book and claim to be Euripides. It happened in the ancient world. It happened a lot. And I've given talks about this to various groups, including Biblical Archaeology Society, and I always get the response, well, wasn't that an accepted practice in the ancient world? Because that's what everybody thinks, is that it was an accepted practice in the ancient world. And the reason everybody thinks that is because scholars say that all the time. And the point of my lecture is that those scholars are wrong. It was not an accepted practice in the ancient world, and I'm going to try and show it to you. Okay? That's what this lecture is about. So, to start with, after the New Testament was written, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the other 27 books of the New Testament, There were writers, Christian writers, who continued to write. And throughout history, of course, Christians have been interested not only in what the New Testament said, but what did other Christians say from just after the time of the New Testament? Before the Enlightenment, so say before the 18th century, if you were to ask a scholar what he thought were the books written right after the New Testament period, that scholar, before the 18th century, would have said, well, some of the most interesting and important books from right after the New Testament are the letters of Paul and the Roman philosopher Seneca. We have an exchange of 12 letters between Paul and the greatest philosopher of the first century, Seneca. We still have these letters. What the pre-Enlightenment scholar did not know is that these letters were not written by Paul and Seneca. These letters actually were not written between Paul and Seneca. They were written in the 4th century by somebody claiming to be both Paul and Seneca in order to show that Paul was revered by the greatest philosopher of the 1st century. But the letters weren't written by them. They're forged. There were the writings of Dionysius the Areopagite. one of the early converts of the Apostle Paul, mystical reflections on the meaning of God that everybody thought were writings of Paul's early convert. Wrong, they're forged. There were 13 letters of the Bishop of Antioch named Ignatius. 13 letters circulating in his name. Today we know that 6 of these 13 were written 300 years after Ignatius was dead by a forger claiming to be Ignatius. So of the 13 letters, 6 are forged. There were accounts of the missionary activities and exploits of a man named Clement, Bishop of Rome, one of the early popes, appointed by Peter himself to be Pope of Rome. And these homilies and recognitions, as they're called, describe Clement's conversion to the faith by Peter and his missionary escapades. Very long books that everybody before the Enlightenment thought really were written by Clement. As it turned out, there's no way they were written by Clement. They were written 300 years after he was dead. Therefore, in Clement's name. So if you were to ask a scholar from before the 1800s, what books you have that were after the New Testament, these are the books he'd come up with, and none of them, as it turns out, are authentic. All of them are written in the name of somebody who didn't actually write them. Today, when you ask scholars, what books are from after the New Testament? They will tell you, well, we have a bunch of Gospels, the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of James. All of these books claim to be written by these people. And these people didn't write any of these books. The same with the Pauline letters. We have the letters of Seneca that I mentioned. We still have a letter to the Laodiceans, and we have from Paul. And we know about a letter that we no longer have called the letter to the Alexandrians. Paul didn't write any of these letters. They're forged. We have apocalypses. Just like in the New Testament, you have the Apocalypse of John, the book of Revelation. Outside the New Testament, we have the Apocalypse of Peter, where Peter is given a tour of the realms of the blessed and the realms of the damned. We have the Apocalypse of Paul, where Paul is also given a tour of heaven and hell. Peter and Paul didn't write these books. They're forged. All of these are forgeries. My point here is that there are a lot of forgeries going on in the ancient world, including among the Christians. People writing books claiming to be people that they weren't. Within the Bible, there are books that claim to be written by people who did not write them. Much of the Hebrew Bible is anonymous. The authors don't claim to be anybody in particular. But there are a couple of books that claim to be authored by people who certainly did not write them. The book of Daniel describes the visions of the 6th century BCE prophet Daniel. And in fact, the book was written 500 years later, in the 2nd century. So 400 years later, in the 2nd century. Daniel was not really written by Daniel. It was written by somebody during the Maccabean Revolt in the 2nd century. The book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is an interesting instance because Ecclesiastes doesn't actually claim to be written by Solomon per se. In other words, the author doesn't say, my name is Solomon. What he says is that he's the son of David, and he's the king who rules in Jerusalem, and he's very wise and very wealthy. So who do you think that might be? I mean, so he's claiming to be Solomon without giving his name Solomon, but it certainly was not written by Solomon in the 10th century BCE. It was probably written about 700 years later, as scholars would tell you. In the New Testament, the New Testament contains 27 books. 13 of them claim to be written by Paul. The scholarly consensus is that only 7 of them were certainly written by Paul. The other 6 probably were not written by Paul. Ephesians, Colossians, 2 Thessalonians, 1 and 2 Timothy, and Titus claim to be written by Paul, but they weren't written by Paul, probably. 2 books claim to be written by Peter, probably weren't written by Peter. James probably wasn't written by James, and Jude probably wasn't written by Jude. Now, in this lecture, I'm not going to give you the evidence for any of this. I'm just telling you what scholars have concluded on the basis of years and years and years and years of analysis. 10 out of the 27 books of the New Testament probably were not written by the people who are claimed as their authors. There are other books that are anonymous. In other words, the author doesn't tell you who he is, but somebody later reading the book said, oh yeah, that was written by so-and-so. like the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew doesn't claim to be written by somebody named Matthew. It's written anonymously in the third person. The author never talks about himself in the first person. Never says, well, one day Jesus and I went up to Jerusalem and we did this or that. It's all about what they were doing. And the author doesn't say who he is. Well, that's true not only of Matthew, it's also true of Mark, Luke, and John. It's also true of the book of Acts. The book of Hebrews is anonymous. The three letters of John are anonymous. And the Apocalypse of John is not anonymous. Whoever wrote the last book of the New Testament called himself John. The thing is, he didn't tell you which John he was. There were lots of Johns floating around, and later church fathers said, oh yeah, this is John the son of Zebedee, Jesus' disciple. And so they accepted it as part of the New Testament because they thought John the son of Zebedee wrote it, even though almost certainly he didn't write it. Okay, so that's a little different case. Well, you can tell a lot of the books of the New Testament are involved in this question, both of forgery and of false attribution. Let me define my terms, just so we're all on the same page. One common term used to describe the phenomenon that I'm talking about now is pseudonymity. Pseudonymity refers to books that are falsely named. A pseudonymous book is a book that goes under the name of somebody who did not actually write it. Pseudonymous. There are, though, two kinds of pseudonymous writings. Sometimes people write just using a pen name. And so, for example, when Mark Twain wrote Huckleberry Finn and signed it Mark Twain, that actually wasn't his name. His name was Samuel Clemens. Well, why didn't he just sign it Samuel Clemens? Well, he liked the pen name Mark Twain. It'd be different if he wrote Huckleberry Finn and then signed it Charles Dickens. Right? Then he'd be claiming to be somebody that he's not. When he writes and says he's Mark Twain, he's just picking a name out of the air that he likes. Or when George Eliot writes Silas Marner or Middlemarch and signs it George Eliot, she's not claiming to be someone else. You know, she doesn't write and claim to be Thackeray. She's picking a name. It's a pen name that she chooses. That happened in the ancient world. We do have instances of people writing books in the ancient world under a pen name. One of the famous works from the classical period is Xenophon's Anabasis, which was written, Xenophon didn't sign it. Xenophon, he signed it Themistogenes. He picked a fictitious name. So, you don't get that kind of thing too often in Christianity, but it's one kind of pseudonymity. The other kind of pseudonymity is when somebody writes a book and signs off in a famous name. I'm calling that pseudepigraphy, which literally means written under a false name. Written under a false name, meaning a name that other people know. So pen names are innocent names, and pseudepigraphy involves known names, but there are two kinds of pseudepigraphy. Pseudepigraphy, falsely inscribed, in other words, written under a false name, two kinds. Sometimes a book is pseudepigraphic. It is pseudepigraphic because it is falsely attributed to a famous person. And so when whoever wrote Matthew didn't claim to be anybody famous, he didn't claim to be anybody. He wrote it anonymously. Later, people said, oh yeah, that was written by Matthew. Well, they were wrong about that probably, but it's not the author's fault. You know what I mean? The author didn't claim to be that person. Someone else said it was him. And so there's no problem with that, with you writing anonymously and somebody else coming along and saying that you were somebody famous. The other kind of pseudepigraphy is when an author writes a book falsely claiming to be someone he's not. That is what I'm calling forgery. And so my definition of forgery, a book whose author falsely claims to be a well-known person. That's why I mean by forgery. I don't mean anything else, just that. Okay? So that's the phenomenon I'm interested in. People writing books claiming to be well-known people, even though they're not that person. Right? Okay, so those are the terms. Many people get upset when I use the term forgery for ancient books, especially when I start talking about the books of the Bible. I mean, after all, it's the Bible we're talking about here, and you shouldn't say nasty things about it. And calling a book a forgery in the Bible is, you're walking on thin ice here. That's why a lot of scholars who write on this, when they refer to books written in the name of a famous person by somebody who was not really that person, when they talk about those books inside the New Testament, they will often call them pseudepigrapha. When they're books outside the New Testament and it's exactly the same phenomenon, they'll call them forgeries. But it's the same phenomenon. It's the same thing, whether it got into the Bible or didn't get into the Bible. It's the same thing. And so I prefer keeping my terms straight. Is the term forgery, though, too negative as a meaning? I mean, in modern period, forgery means something that's deceitful and lying. And I mean, you really want to say that about these ancient writings? You want to have use a term that is so negative about them. Now, I will say, one thing I'll say about that is forgery today is different from forgery in the ancient world to the extent that most kinds of forgeries today are illegal. We have laws about such things. You can't write a book and claim to be Barack Obama and publish it. You'll get in trouble for that. And in the ancient world, it's true, they did not have laws against forgery. But they didn't have laws about lots of things in the ancient world that we have laws about today. And so the fact that they did or did not have laws doesn't really matter much for me. The question is, did ancient people have negative associations with this phenomenon of forgery or not? What I want to argue is that people in the ancient world also found this to be a deceitful, lying practice, and it was not widely accepted. And people didn't say it's okay to do, contrary to what many New Testament scholars will tell you. So one way to get to that is to think in terms of what the ancient people called this ancient practice. So forgery is an English word. What ancient words were used? So the materials that I work on mainly are Greek. And so let me just tell you what the Greeks called these what I'm calling forgery. Two terms. There are several terms, such as the word pseudonymous, the term pseudepigraphy. Those are formed from Greek words based on the Greek word pseudos. A pseudos was a lie. If you didn't know that what you were saying was wrong, you could call it a falsehood. But if you said something wrong, and you knew it was wrong, and you said it anyway, that would be what we would call a lie. Well, they called these books lies. I don't think they're calling them falsehoods, because whoever writes a book claiming to be Paul when he's not really Paul probably knows that he's not really Paul. And so he's lying about it. And so that's one word they use, the pseudos word. The second word they use is a word we don't know, nothos. Nothos is the word that is used by ancient Greeks to refer to an illegitimate child, a bastard, a child born out of wedlock. Books that are that claim to be written by people who did not really write them are called nothos. They're called bastards. And so you say, well, forgery is too negative of a term. Well, you know, what did ancient people call it? They called them lies and bastards. So they were pretty negative, too. So it isn't that, you know, I've taken some kind of concept that was neutral in the ancient world and put on some kind of derogatory connotation on it. In fact, it was negative back then. Did ancient forgers intend to deceive? Well, if you lie, you're trying to get somebody to believe something that's not true for purposes of your own. You're trying to deceive them. If a forger wrote a book in somebody else's name, was he really trying to deceive somebody or not? My contention is that ancient people who wrote books in the names of other people really were trying to deceive people, to get them to think that they were the other person. So let me give you a couple anecdotes to illustrate the point. The first is an interesting case from the 4th century BCE. involving a man named Dionysius and a man named Heraclides. Heraclides was a very famous writer in the days of Plato and Aristotle. He wrote extensively on a number of topics. He was one of the leading literary figures in ancient Athens. He had a student named Dionysius who had a falling out with him. And after their falling out, Dionysius decided that he wanted to pull a trick on his former teacher. What Dionysius did is he wrote a play, he penned a play called the Parthenopaeus. A play called the Parthenopaeus, and he signed it Sophocles. And so he put it in circulation claiming that this is a play of Sophocles. Heraclides got his hand on this play and thought it really was a play of Sophocles. And so he quoted it in one of his literary works, which is just what Dionysius wanted. When Dionysius found that Heraclides had been fooled into thinking this really was a play by Sophocles, Dionysius sprung the trap. And he said, actually, this isn't a play of Sophocles, I wrote it. Well, Heraclides didn't believe him. And so Dionysius took the play and he showed him that if you take the first few lines and you take the first letter of the first few lines and string those together into a word, it spells the name Pankalos. Pankalos was Dionysius' male lover. Well, Heraclides says it's just an accident. You know, you do this kind of games with anything. Well, then later, so you know, you make an acrostic of the first letters of the lines. And so it turns out there's another acrostic hidden in the play. And he showed him another one later down in the play. And this acrostic said, an old monkey is not caught in a trap. Yes, he is caught, but it takes some time. So Heraclides is starting to get suspicious that maybe he's been had. And then Dionysius shows him the final acrostic that he invented in the play, which said, Heraclides is ignorant of letters and is not ashamed of his ignorance. So the game was up. I mean, there it was. It's clear as day. He forged this thing and fooled his firm. And so now, the question is, was he trying to deceive Heraclides? Yes, he was trying to deceive Heraclides. The whole point of this thing wouldn't work unless Heraclides had been deceived. Okay, so that's just one illustration. There are hundreds of these things that you get from the ancient world. The libraries of Alexandria and Pergamum. Today, we have libraries in every town and city in North America. Everybody has a library. Everybody can go and borrow books. It wasn't that way in the ancient world. Very, very few places had libraries. And the libraries that existed didn't have borrowing privileges the way we think of them. They stored books that scholars could go to the library and use the book, but they would leave them there. The two biggest libraries in the ancient world were the libraries of Alexandria, Egypt, and Pergamum on the western coast of what is now Turkey. They were in competition with one another to increase their holdings. The kings of Alexandria and Pergamum wanted to have the best library in the world, both of them did, and they were in competition. And so they paid money, gold on the head, for original copies of great authors. Euripides, Sophocles, Aeschylus, Plato, Aristotle. If you have original copies of these things, these kings would be willing to buy them. The reason they wanted original copies was because if you have a copy of the original, the person copying it might have made a mistake here or there, and you aren't sure you have the original words of the author himself. And so you want the real thing. If kings are paying gold on the head for original copies of Plato, you'd be amazed how many original copies of Plato start showing up. Because it's worth something. And so we have evidence from the ancient world that, in fact, these libraries led to the forgery of books in the name of the great literary greats. Now, if you forge something, if you forge a dialogue in the name of Plato and try and sell it to the library, of course it's not going to work if they know that you forged it. So of course you have to deceive them. That's the only way it works. Consider another anecdote, the aspersions to Diotimus. Diotimus was a philosopher in the 4th century BCE who was an opponent of the great philosopher Epicurus. Epicurus started Epicureanism, which has a bad reputation today because you think of an Epicurean as somebody who's into physical pleasure and that lives for a hedonistic lifestyle. And that actually is not what Epiphanius, that's not what Epicurus advocated. Epicurus advocated living a simple life and enjoying the simple pleasures in life, avoiding pain as much as possible and enjoying the simple pleasures of life. Friends and family and intellectual discourse and the good things in life. But he had a reputation for being interested in pleasure. And Diotimus was one of his philosophical enemies who decided that he would play a trick on Epicurus. And what he did is he wrote 50 obscene letters and signed them Epicurus. And put them in circulation to sully the reputation of his enemy. Well, that didn't sit well with Epicurus's followers, one of whom, a guy named Zeno, tracked down Diotimus and murdered him. So the question is, was Diotimus trying to fool people? Of course he was. If people knew that Epicurus had not written these letters, then the trick wouldn't work. You can go through all the various motivations for people forging documents and letters and writings in the ancient world, and in virtually every case, the only reason the motivation works is because the person is trying to deceive somebody or lots of somebodies. Forgers meant to deceive, that's why they engaged in forgery. That's why they would claim to be somebody else. Nonetheless, New Testament scholars often claim that the practice of writing forgery was not meant to be a deceptive practice in the ancient world, and that it was an acceptable practice. The New Testament scholars who say this, they say it all the time, by the way. I mean, I'm a New Testament scholar. I've lived with these people for about 35 years. I know what they say, what I used to say is that it was an accepted practice in the ancient world. And there are two reasons for scholars saying this. The first has to do with the philosophical schools of antiquity. What is commonly stated is that within the philosophical schools of the ancient world, so the school of Plato, he had followers, and so you call his followers listening to Plato, you call that a school, where they trained and they learned Platonic philosophy. Aristotle had a school. Pythagoras had a school. All these great philosophers had schools. What is commonly said is that the philosophers in the school would write treatises in the name of their master and then sign their master's name, on the assumption that any thoughts that they had were not their own thoughts, they were the thoughts given them by their master. And so it would be an act of hubris to sign their own name when all of their ideas are being given from the master. So some of you are shaking your head, yes, you've heard this explanation before. It's the explanation I used to give all the time, for years. Let me quote you a New Testament scholar who says this, writing, this is a scholar who's written one of the definitive commentaries on the New Testament book of Colossians. Colossians is one of those books that claims to be written by Paul, but probably was not written by Paul. And this author, this commentator, is trying to explain how that was okay for somebody to claim to be Paul when he wasn't Paul. What this author says, his name is Marcus Barth, B-A-R-T-H, is the son of Karl Barth, you know, theology. Pseudonymous documents, especially letters with philosophical content, were set in circulation because disciples of a great man intended to express by imitation their adoration of their revered master and to secure or to promote his influence upon a later generation under changed circumstances. So you're just trying to get your master's ideas out there until you would sign your master's name. Or a more recent commentator on Colossians and Ephesians, another book that claims to be written by Paul but wasn't, Margaret McDonald, a very fine scholar, says, viewing Colossians or Ephesians as deutero-Pauline, meaning not really Paul, but secondary, should not be mistakenly understood as meaning that these documents are simply examples of forgery. For example, to write in the name of a philosopher who was one's patron could be seen as a sign of honor bestowed upon this person. Okay? So that's the kind of comment you get in New Testament scholars about how it was okay if you were a follower of Paul to write a book claiming to be Paul. I want to contend that this, in fact, is not true. And so what I did is I decided to look to see what the evidence is that it was okay in philosophical schools to write in the name of your master. And most of the time, it's very hard to know what the evidence is that these people have in mind. When Marcus Barthes said that, there was no footnote telling you what ancient author says that that was the case. Or when Margaret McDonald wrote that, there was no footnote to say, well, yeah, that's said by so-and-so or so-and-so. And I started realizing that New Testament scholars say this in their commentaries because that's what they learned when they were in graduate school from other New Testament scholars who have read it in books. And the authors of those books learned it from other books, who learned it from other books, who learned it from other books. And so since everybody says it, then everybody assumes it's true. But you ask, well, what evidence is there that that's true? Apart from the fact that all New Testament scholars seem to think that it's true. Well, it took a lot of work, but I tracked down, I think, what the ancient sources are. For the two primary sources are used for this idea that it was widely common in philosophical schools for students to write in their master's name. There are two comments from the ancient world that may be used as evidence. The first is the evidence of a Neoplatonic philosopher named Porphyry. Porphyry was a very famous Neoplatonic philosopher of the third Christian century, going into the fourth Christian century, who was talking at one place in his writings about the school of philosophy, the Pythagorean school. He's talking about the Pythagoreans. It is commonly stated by people who've actually dug and looked for the sources from this point of view that Porphyry tells us, it's commonly stated that Porphyry tells us that the followers of Pythagoras wrote books in his name and signed his name to them. That's what scholars will tell you. The scholars will bother to look up the references. Now, the problem is, this passage in Porphyry is a little bit hard to find. Porphyry wrote in Greek, but this passage does not survive in the Greek manuscripts of Porphyry's writings. It only survives in a medieval Arabic translation of one of Porphyry's writings. My guess is that there is no New Testament scholar on the planet who has actually read this comment of Porphyry, because it's written in a medieval Arabic manuscript. Well, I don't read medieval Arabic either, but I have a colleague who does, and I asked him to read the passage for me, and it turns out it does not say what people says it says. What Porphyry says is that Pythagoras himself wrote 80 books, his followers wrote 200 books, and there are 12 books that are forged in the name of Pythagoras. That's all he says. What scholars have thought he said, and will say that he said, is that Pythagoras wrote 80 books, his followers wrote 200 books in his name, and 12 were forged. It doesn't say that. It says he wrote 80 books, his followers wrote 200 books, and 12 were forged in his name. Well, we have books of Pythagoras' followers. They're not written in Pythagoras' name. They're written in the name of the person who wrote the book. This piece of evidence is not evidence. This doesn't say anything about the phenomenon. of somebody claiming to be writing the name of the master. Okay? See, that's one of the two pieces of evidence for it being a common practice in the ancient world. So we're left with one piece of evidence for this being a common practice in the ancient world, the ambligus. In this case, Iamblichus does say what scholars say that he says. Here's what he says. This is just one sentence in a huge corpus of writings by one philosopher about Pythagoras. Okay? Iamblichus, by the way, is living 800 years after Pythagoras. So it'd be like somebody today making a one-sentence comment about something that about a scholar who lived in the year 1300. Okay? That's what we're dealing with here. The one sentence that he has is this. This also is a beautiful circumstance that they, Pythagoras' followers, referred everything to Pythagoras and called it by his name. They did not ascribe to themselves the glory of their own inventions, except very rarely, for there are very few whose works are acknowledged to be their own. That's it. That's what he said. So, this is the one piece of evidence that people point to for it being a common practice in philosophical schools for people to write in the name of the masters, which is why Paul's followers could do that with impunity. Okay? This is the one piece of evidence. Well, let's think about this piece of evidence for a second. Does Iamblichus cite a widely recognized phenomenon? Well, if it was a widely recognized phenomenon, it's passing strange that nobody mentions it for 800 years. Iamblichus is the only author to mention it. So if it's widely practiced, why doesn't anybody say anything about it? Does he recognize the phenomenon of the first century when the New Testament books are being written? When Paul's followers are writing books claiming to be Paul? Well, he's living 200 years later. What does he know about what's going on in 200 years before? It's hard enough for us to know what authors are thinking 200 years ago, and we have libraries and data retrieval systems and all sorts of access. Ancient people didn't have these things. How does he know what's going on 200 years? Well, he probably had no idea what was going on 200 years earlier. Does he recognize a phenomenon scattered throughout the philosophical schools? There were lots of philosophical schools, and he mentioned only the Pythagoreans from 800 years earlier. And as it turns out, he's probably not right even about the Pythagoreans, as recent scholars of Pythagoras have shown. And so the most recent study of the Pythagorean school is by a guy named Shmood, it's a German book, study of Pythagoras, and he looked at this comment of Iamblichus, and he shows that in fact it's probably not true, what he says about Iamblichus 800 years earlier. Because the followers of Iamblichus actually wrote books in their own names. And when somebody forged a book claiming to be Pythagoras, people objected to it, just like our other evidence. Porphyry objected to the 12 forgeries written in Pythagoras' name. And so he's probably not even right about Pythagoras. He's certainly not right about a broad thing within the philosophical schools, and he's writing 800 years after the fact. Is this the best explanation for what's going on in early Christianity? Well, it seems to be extremely remote from anything having to do with early Christianity. These are the two pieces of evidence, then, that people cite from the philosophy perspective. Now, you can continue believing that this happened in philosophical schools if you want. I mean, you can believe anything you want. People obviously do. But historians have to ask, what is the evidence? If that's the evidence, we have basically no evidence. So it's a nice thought, but is it true? Well, it doesn't look like it. What do we have evidence for? What we have evidence for is dozens and dozens, hundreds of people writing in the name of someone else in order to deceive their readers. We got lots of evidence of that. Do we have evidence of philosophical schools writing in the name of the master? No, not really. We just have that one sentence. All right, so there's another idea among New Testament scholars that tries to excuse somebody claiming to be Paul but not really Paul. Somebody writing Colossians saying, my name is Paul,
the Apostle Paul to the church in Colossae, or claiming to be Peter and writing the book that is 1 Peter, or claiming to be Jesus' brother James and writing the letter of James. There's another theory that tries to explain how that can happen, and it's what I call the secretary hypothesis. The secretary hypothesis is, again, a view that I used to hold for years. I used to agree with this. I thought this was true because I read it in New Testament scholars. And all New Testament scholars say this. And if New Testament scholars say it, they surely wouldn't tell you something that's not true, and so it's probably right. And so I was convinced it was probably true. Then I listened to the evidence. So the secondary hypothesis works. The thing about the secondary hypothesis is it makes a lot of sense just innately when somebody explains it to you. Sounds, oh yeah, that sounds right. So the way it works is this. Ancient people tended to dictate their writings to somebody. So most people who were writing didn't actually do the writing themselves. They would dictate, especially the upper class people would dictate, and a scribe would write it down. Well, some scribes might change the style, the grammar, the words that are being dictated might actually change them in places. And if the secretary had the freedom to change what the person was telling them, isn't it possible that Paul dictated letters to different scribes, and different scribes incorporated their own writing style, so that the book of Colossians that does not look like one of Paul's writings might be different simply because it was a different scribe? That makes perfect sense. And, you know, it's very persuasive. And it's what New Testament scholars say all the time. You find it all over the place in New Testament scholars. And so the question is it true? Did that happen in the ancient world or not? Is it possible that a scribe, in fact, would simply be told, look, write a letter for me. There's a problem going on in Philippi, and I want to tell them this. So to just write them a letter and tell them that. And then the scribe composes the letter. So that it has what Paul wanted to be said, basically, but it doesn't sound like Paul. Okay, so the scribe composed the letter for him. Is that possible? Well, that's a great question. So the most thorough study of this is by a guy named E. Randolph Richards, the secretary in the letters of Paul. And I should say, quite frankly, that Richards believes that this happened. He believes that secretaries were responsible for the various styles that you find in the Pauline letters. So I worked through this book several times very carefully to find out what evidence he had that this was a common practice in the ancient world. I mean, it's one thing to say this happened, but it's another thing to give evidence that it happened. That scribes would sometimes compose letters for the people they're writing for. What Richards showed, Richards, by the way, this is an accessible book. You can get this book. It's still available. You can read it. And it's an interesting book in a lot of ways because he looks at every reference to secretaries in the ancient world. In the New Testament, there are references to secretaries. I don't know if you noticed this, but in Romans chapter 16, Paul's letter to the Romans, in chapter 16, Paul is greeting all the people in the congregation there in Rome. And at one point, you get this very strange verse that says, I, Tertius, the writer of this letter, greet you. Tertius? I mean, this is Paul writing. Yeah, well, it's Paul dictating the letter. Tertius is the guy who's writing it down. And when Paul's greeting everybody, Tertius thought, oh, yeah, just a second, I need to greet everybody. And so he wrote it, I, Tertius, greet you. So he was the secretary being used to write. So Paul certainly used secretary. That's why in the book of Galatians, at the end of Galatians, Paul's written this letter, this kind of angry letter, and at the end of it, he says, see with what large letters I'm writing to you. That's a weird thing to say, but what's happened is he's dictated the letter, and somebody's copied it down, and now he's signing off himself, and he writes with bigger letters than the guy than the secretary he was using, either because he was going blind or because he wasn't skilled in writing or for some other reason. So there's no doubt that Paul did use secretaries. So what Richards does is he wants to examine secretaries in the ancient world. He looks at every reference to secretaries in Greek and Roman sources. And he looks at every letter that we know was written by a secretary that we actually have the original papyrus discovered. So in Egypt, you know, you discover these trash heaps that have old letters and stuff in them, and you can tell which ones were written by secretaries, because secretaries often tell you. And so he studied everything, everything we have. And he concluded that there are four kinds of uses of secretaries, in his opinion. The first is what I was mentioning earlier. Sometimes an author would dictate a letter, and the secretary would write down word for word what he said. Okay? Dictation. That, in fact, is well demonstrated from the ancient evidence. There's lots of instances in which that absolutely happened. Somebody dictated either word for word or syllable by syllable a letter, and somebody wrote it down. They, in fact, invented forms of shorthand in Greek and Latin to help them write down what was being dictated to them. So that absolutely happened. What also occasionally happened is that secretaries could be used in order to kind of copy edit the letters. So if there was a grammatical problem, they could rephrase it grammatically, you know, or if they used the wrong word, they put in the right word, you know, that kind of thing. So very simple, light copy editing kind of thing. There's evidence of that happening. Both those things happen. Those are his first two categories. It's the second two categories that concern us with respect to forgery, and they're the two categories for which there's not evidence. Co-authorship. Richards maintains that sometimes an author would co-author a letter with a scribe, with a secretary, where they would both put input into the letter. He says this happens. Now, I read this very carefully. I read the section in Richard very carefully to look for what evidence is there that this ever happened. So, for example, if Paul says he's writing a letter with Silvanus, then the two of them write different parts of the letter, for example. You know, so there might be two different styles of the letter. So the evidence that Richard cites is one case involving Cicero that Richard says, in fact, does not demonstrate the point. And then he concludes by saying, therefore, scribes are sometimes used as co-authors. I had trouble believing that he said that, because he just given only one example that he discounted. And so I wonder, when he said, therefore, scribes, I wonder what the therefore was there for. You see what I mean? So I wrote him an email. I said, well, so Randy, I don't get it. Because the only example you give of this, you say it doesn't apply. So are there other examples? And he wrote back and he says, no, I don't know of any. Okay, good. So what about somebody who's not a co-author but is a substitute author? What about, one day Paul says, look, Timothy, I'm too busy. I've got to go give a missionary sermon here or there or whatever. I've got to write those Christians in Thessalonica. Would you just sit down and tell them that it's okay and that this is what's going to happen and I'll be there in a few weeks? And Timothy says, okay, sure, fine. And he writes the letter and he signs it Paul. And Paul closes it. Did that sort of thing ever happen? That's the question. So that you're not, you're just doing what he told you to do. Well, I think the answer is no. I'll show you why. There are one or two instances in Cicero where that appears to have happened, where Cicero told his trusted scribe to write a letter in his name to someone else. It's true. It's Cicero that happens. It happens so rarely and only in Cicero that Richards concludes that this was not a practice in the ancient world, and that the evidence is limited to Cicero. It's important to point out that Cicero was at the very upper crust, elite, highly educated, extremely wealthy, upper crust, aristocratic Roman guy. That's Cicero. Who was Paul? He was like way down there. The other issue is short and stereotypical letters versus essays in letter form. When Cicero wrote a letter, we have Cicero's letters, tons of them. We have Cicero's letters. Cicero's letters are very brief and compact, like almost all letters were in the ancient world. Usually the letters in the ancient world were just one-pagers, where you'd state your name, you'd state who you're writing to, you would greet them, you'd say a prayer to the gods on their behalf, and then you'd have just a few lines indicating what you're writing about, and then you'd have a closing and you'd sign off. Boom, 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 and done. One page. Those are ancient letters. We have hundreds and hundreds of copies of ancient letters that have turned up. How does that compare with Paul's letter to the Ephesians? Well, I don't know if you've read Ephesians lately, but it is not boom, 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 and done. It is several pages long, deeply thought out, highly intricate, theologically argued, filled with substance. It's more like a treatise in letter form. So too 1 Peter, or Colossians, or 1 Timothy. These are long, these are not stereotypical letters. It would be one thing to say, Cicero saying, look, send a letter to Rufus and tell him that I'm coming next week. Boom, 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 and done. It's another thing to say, write to the Ephesians and explain to them, and then giving this entire theological discourse. That somebody, so this evidence from these stereotypical letters doesn't apply to essays in letter form. By conclusion, there is not a single piece of evidence from the ancient world of a secretary writing a lengthy and involved letter in someone else's name. There is not a single instance of it that we know of. So you say, well, that's probably what happened in Paul's case, is he told somebody to write a letter for him. Okay, if that's probably what happened, why is there no evidence that it ever happened? Now, if evidence doesn't matter to you, then you can believe anything you want. If evidence does matter to you, then you should go where the evidence leads. What we have evidence for is lots of instances of people writing to be people that they weren't, somebody writing in the name of a famous person in order to deceive others into thinking that they were that person. We have lots of evidence for that. No evidence for the secretary hypothesis. So, which way do you want to go? Well, it's up to your personal temperament. Conclusions. Forgery in the early church. How common was it? It was a widespread practice within early Christianity for people to write books claiming to be people that they weren't. Was it widely recognized as deceitful? Yes, it was recognized as deceitful. We have warnings against forgery in all sorts of writings. It is very interesting to notice that sometimes we find warnings against forgeries in books that are forged. Where a forger will warn you not to read forgeries. Why? Well, because if he warns you not to read forgeries, you don't think that he's a forger. He throws you off the scent of his own deceit. How did forgers justify it to themselves? Well, I think, I don't have much time for this. I'm just going to do this in 20 seconds. I think this is how it works. I don't know how most people did it. Christians were particularly invested in their understanding of their religion. Their understanding of their religion was very important. It had eternal consequences. There were people in the ancient world who thought that there are instances in which it's okay to lie. If your daughter has to be deceived into taking her medicine that will make her well, it's okay to lie to her to get her to take the medicine. If you're fighting a battle and your troops are getting worn out, it's okay to lie to them to say that reinforcements are coming so they'll fight more bravely. That's okay. There are instances in which it's okay to lie. And I think the people who wrote these books, claiming to be someone they weren't, thought, in this instance, it's okay to lie. The irony, of course, is that Christians thought they were proclaiming the truth, which means that they thought it was okay to lie in order to promote the truth. A bit ironic. Could there be forgeries in the New Testament? Yes, there could be forgeries in the New Testament. Why couldn't there be forgeries in the New Testament? There are lots of other forgeries floating around. The church fathers who put the New Testament together 300 years afterwards, they had no idea who wrote these books. They had no way of knowing who wrote these books. These books were debated, by the way, in early Christianity. There were people who were saying that 1 Timothy was not written by Paul. that 2 Peter was not written by Peter. The people in the early church, the Revelation was not written by John the son of Zebedee. You had people in the early church who said these things, but they lost out. The group that ended up thinking these books, in fact, were written by the people who claimed them as the authors are the side that won out, and they decided what ended up in the New Testament. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.